The Mike Lupica Podcast.
We are back now with the great Mike Lupica. He's one of the country's
most prominent
sports columnists.
Mike Lupica has covered just about every sport.
Candid interviews with legends he calls friends.
I was talking to Jordan about Woods after the basketball game the other night. Everybody in sports to be the next this guy, the next this guy. And Michael said, no, he's the first Tiger.
In your face questions.
How much of a dope is he?
Compelling.
A $1 billion industry, the biggest we've ever had in sports in this country, often comes down to a flip of the coin.
This is the Mike Lupica Podcast. Here's Mike Lupica.
Hello and thanks for joining us on the Mike Lupica Podcast. Today we will be joined by one of the best and smartest and most interesting political commentators on the planet, a longtime Democratic strategist. He's the great James Carville. But before we get started with James, I want to tell you about our good friends at Peter Manning Clothing. If you're tired of wearing baggy, oversized clothes, never finding your size, or having to take everything to the tailor, then I beseech you to check out Peter Manning NYC. Peter Manning has developed a fresh line of apparel specifically designed for us not-so-tall guys. Pants shouldn't bunch up at your ankles, shirts shouldn't hang down to your knees, and jackets shouldn't wear like a tent. You'll feel good and look great wearing proper-fitting clothes. They guarantee it. It's changed thousands of lives, and it'll change yours, too. No more baggy pants, no more pirate arms, and no more tailor tacks. Visit them online at www.petermanningnyc.com. Be sure to use the promo code LUPICA for 20% off your order, or check them out in Manhattan, as I did, at 933 Broadway, and discover a great fit. I've gone there. My son has gone there. We love it. This is an honest and heartfelt recommendation. www.petermanningnyc.com. Be sure to use code LUPICA for 20% off your order. Welcome back to the Mike Lupica Podcast, and we are happy to be joined today by one of our favorite guests on this podcast. It has been too long since we had him on. James Carville is one of the noted political experts in this country. He is a best-selling author. He is the husband of Mary Matlin. He is the man who first became famous along with Paul Begala running Bill Clinton's presidential campaign back in 25 years ago, more than 25 years ago, and famously wrote these three things up on a board in the war room: change versus more of the same, the economy's stupid, and don't forget health care. Good morning, James.
Good morning. How are you? I'm fine.
How are you? Hey, you know, James, I promise that we will get to talking about your favorite subject right now, the LSU Tigers football team and their tremendous victory over Georgia last Saturday. But James, let's start with what is in the news and what sounds like a moment from the movie Scarface about what apparently happened to Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi in the Saudi consulate in Turkey. And James, what do you make so far of what President Trump's reaction has been?
It's been predictable. And if you think long-term for a second, this country is placing massive bets on Russia and Saudi Arabia and North Korea. We're placing massive bets against China and Iran. Now, what do you think the future of the world is? And of course he's going to be apologetic toward the Saudi regime, just like he was toward the Russian regime. That's who we are. Our foreign policy is a reflection of our country. For a long time, our foreign policy was the Atlantic Alliance, was Japan and Australia and New Zealand and places in East Asia and that kind of stuff. Well, the American alliance has changed. We are now betting on countries that don't have much of a future and betting against countries that have a very rosy future. And I think it's predictable and both predictable and stupid at the same time.
James, I was wondering, and I don't know the answer to this question, did you ever have any interaction or contact with Mr. Khashoggi?
No. I would not have. I mean, I think he mostly wrote, when he was writing, mostly wrote about Saudi issues.
Yeah.
On his own country. And was, by most accounts, was not particularly militant against the government. It was critical, but that was about it. I mean, when you send a guy autopsy expert in an interrogation with a bone saw, that's generally not a very good idea for the person being interrogated.
It seems as the Crown Prince is now trying to provide cover for himself in this thing and dispute that he had any knowledge beforehand about what happened, but it seems to me in the broader context of what we're witnessing play out in real time that this guy is, he talk about making a bet, James, he's making a bet that somehow the loss of life of one Washington Post columnist is just the cost of doing business because the stakes are so high right now with the United States of America.
Well, all right, there are a couple of things that we've got to think about. Number one is, from his vantage point, it just wasn't one troublemaker. That is a message to every other person within Saudi Arabia, outside of Saudi Arabia, that has any inkling whatsoever of criticizing that government. If this happened to him, or what I am told, and actually believe, was relatively mild criticism compared to what they could have had, then you see what's behind his calculation. Now, there's also a lot of opinion leaders in this country who were sucking up to this guy left and right. And I can't tell you their names, but their initials are Tom Friedman and David Ignatius.
We're talking to James Carville on the Mike Lupica podcast, and the whole world is watching what apparently, and we're all believing now, has happened to Mr. Khashoggi plays out. I'm going to read you something from Dexter Filkins, who's a great, great journalist in The New Yorker today, okay? The latest evidence pointing to MBS as the Crown Prince's direct involvement in the identities of members of the team sent to Istanbul to kill Khashoggi. Several of the individuals identified by Turkish officials were part of the Royal Guard responsible for protecting senior members of the House of Saud. Quote, they answered directly to MBS, Bruce Rydell, a former Middle East specialist for the CIA and National Security Council, told me, James, is there any, in your mind, is there any dispute that the Crown Prince was behind this?
Look, Mike, I don't think it is, but because all of the evidence points that way and all of the logic points that way. They do not tolerate any dissent at all. There's some idea, and I mean, I'd love to hear Dexter on this, that our intelligence knew this was coming, and at a minimum, we failed to warn Khashoggi. And that would be, the consequence of that would be unbelievable. There are some more on the outer bounds of conspiracy that think that he got the go-ahead to do it from senior people in administration. I don't know that. I actually don't want to believe it. But I got to tell you, it's sort of part of the conversation. But the idea that we knew something was coming and didn't inform is a serious, serious charge. And people like Dexter Filkins and that need to look hard into that.
And it's extraordinary that when you look at Mohammed bin Salman, okay, the Crown Prince, this again from Dexter Filkins' column, James, when the Crown Prince visited the United States earlier this year, he was feted in Hollywood and Silicon Valley on Wall Street and, of course, by the Trump White House as a messiah in the mold of Gorbachev or Gandhi. Quote, historic night it was, end quote. Dwayne The Rock Johnson, the actor, wrote on Instagram of a dinner with MBS hosted by Rupert Murdoch at his vineyard in Bel Air. So my question to you is, no matter what the facts are of this thing, do you believe it's going to change this country's relationship with the Crown Prince?
Well, let's back up. First of all, a lot of people I met with him are business people. They don't have intelligence, and they're, of course, Saudi sovereign wealth funds and Aramco and all of that. So I'd be a little, they would have probably met with the previous Saudi regime.
Right.
Not like we don't have some modicum of business there. But what gets to me is that we are siding with Saudi Arabia and deciding against Iran.
Right.
You know, there are more books that are published, three times more books that are published in Iran every year than are published in the entire Arab world.
Right.
And I'm not saying we can have warm or even neutral relationships with Iran, but I don't think we need to be making them our enemy at every point of what we're doing. And I think it's a bad bet. Trump is back. That was his first visit as president, was to Saudi Arabia. So none of this should really be a surprise to anybody. He was very forgiven of the Russian government for interfering in our election. He was making excuses for him. He said Putin looked in the eye, said they didn't. There's literally not a person in the intelligence community of the United States that does not believe that Russia interjected himself in our election to the benefit of Donald Trump and to the detriment of Hillary Clinton. It's just a fact. So, yeah, this is makes for a good headline, and it shows something, but I'd have to say I'm not surprised at what happened, nor I'm surprised at my own government's reaction to what happened.
We're talking to my friend James Carville on the Mike Lubega podcast, and the Saudis quickly cracked the case with the 45th president of the United States, James, and which they found out that a guy who's, you know, makes a big thing out of how he doesn't drink, that his drug of choice is flattery. And they flattered the shit out of him when he made his first big trip over there. And it's now paying dividends. And when you listen to him talk about this whole case, he's clearly saying, hey, we've got this big arms deal going on. And again, he makes it sound, without coming out to say it, is that the death of one columnist is just the cost of doing business.
Well, let's start. He has another affinity besides the flattery, and that's money. But however much the Saudis are capable of flattery, they're much more capable of money.
Right.
At the end of the day, we're going to find out that that had a lot to do with this. Okay? And he doesn't care. I mean, he calls journalists in his own country enemies of the people. So, and he admires authoritarianism. It was the first place he visited. He spoke glowingly of it. I think it was Wilbur Ross that mentioned what a great country. Unlike the messy French or the Germans, they don't have protesters, and they don't have, you know, people shooting their mouth off and expressing opinions and stuff like that. It's sort of a Trumpian paradise, if you will. It's all of the right people have all of the money, and everybody else shuts up.
James, when you look at his response to this so far, and what may be willful ignorance of the intelligence that he's getting on this, and this may sound like an incredibly disingenuous and naive question, but what does this do to this country's standing around the world, or is the bar set so low now that nobody's even remotely surprised by this?
I don't think that anybody is very surprised by it. And I think that there are a lot of psychological people who are making a lot of money drawing up profiles. And really, you know, my advice to all these foreign governments that want to understand Trump is what we talked about. Think money first and flattery second. And after you get beyond that, I don't think there's a whole lot of thought given to this. How much money you can make and how much of my ass can you kiss? And as long as you fulfill that, as long as it's, you know, almost my occupy, then you, and that's what the Saudis figured out early, and they got early to the table, and they do what they want because they know that Trump's not going to do anything about it. It's sad, but it's just what it is.
If this is just, if this presidency just turns out in the end to be an enormous money grab on his part, okay, let me ask you this. Do you honestly believe that he's going to run again in 2020?
Of course I don't believe that.
Oh, you don't?
If you believe that, no. If you believe that, you have to believe two things, right? You have to say, I believe that Donald J. Trump is not a career criminal, all right?
Right.
Which no one believes. And you have to believe that Robert Mueller is an incompetent buffoon, which no one believes.
No one believes.
If those two things are not true, he's not going to get to 2020. And I don't remotely believe either one of them. Either one.
If the Democrats get the House, knowing what you know about this party and the mood of the country and the power that the Congress would then have that would shift back to the Democrats, do you believe he will? They will impeach him?
Yes. I don't think they'll start out, they'll start out with, and his tax returns and value costs. I think when Mueller delivers his report to the Congress, I'll go even further. I think there'll be some Republicans standing behind it.
James, do you think that there is still a plan afoot, even though he is such, as Joe Scarborough always says, a day trader by temperament? Do you think he's got any kind of long game to still get rid of Mueller before that report ever gets to Congress?
Yeah, he's got a game, but the people are telling him that, if you do this, I mean, he obviously can't do it before the midterms. He will try something. He might even at some point be somewhat successful. The problem is he can't get rid of evidence that exists. And my understanding is it has been reported that the New York Attorney General, the Internal Revenue Service, and the Southern District of New York are sitting in on a lot of these interviews. So I don't know anything about it. The only thing, the fascinating thing about this whole cycle is no one knows what Bob Mueller's voice sounds like. When Robert De Niro did him on Saturday Night Live,
right,
he just did it in his own voice because we don't know what this guy sounds like.
Right.
Because he never says anything. But a cobra never says anything either until it bites.
And James, I've been saying this all along. I've said this when we've had this conversation before. Everything that Mueller knows, Trump knows he knows. And when he occasionally goes off on one of these insane Twitter tirades about the fake dossier, and you always wonder, who does he think is actually processing what he means in these 240 characters or less? But he's clearly in a panic because everything Mueller has on him, he knows what he did.
Let's say Mueller's knowledge of what he has is 100. It's perfect, right?
Yeah.
Our knowledge of what Mueller has is kind of 5. We know some people that have pled. We know some people that have been called there. We know a little bit. Trump's knowledge of what Mueller has is like 60 because his lawyers are debriefing everybody. So they know a lot more than we do, but not near as much as Mueller knows.
Right.
And I think Mueller knows a lot, a whole lot.
We're talking to James Carville on the Mike Lupica podcast. Let's talk about the upcoming election. I'm currently in the state of Florida, and the nonstop nastiness of the political ads on television, hour after hour, day after day, is something to behold. But I have been quoting you for months talking about this upcoming election. And you said to me months ago, And I've tried to do this in my bad Carville impression, okay? That you don't know a lot about a lot of things in this world, but you know a lot about smart women, and you believe that the blue wave that everybody's talking about in November is really going to be a wave of those smart women you talked about with me.
Yeah, what I've kind of said is the affluent American Caucasian college-educated female is in a highly agitated state.
Right.
That's my analysis of my kind of favorite demographic. But
right.
A lot of my life, yeah. Gets trimmed. And I find them to be. Most that I know do not like to be grabbed on their private parts and don't like their children shocked. They have an adverse reaction to both of them, and I think they're going to come out and vote. They're going to vote a lot and heavily. I do think that. But I'm kind of worried because his base should get activated. And if any Democrat runs any ad other than Mitch McConnell saying, well, it looks like we're going to have to cut Social Security and Medicare to pay down the debt. Well, that debt was caused by their gazillion-dollar tax, corporate tax rate. And if Democrats run on that in the last 3 weeks, almost 3 years of this campaign, they will win easily. If they try to run on other things, they will win some seats, but not as many as they could. They'll
James,
win everything if they just run on that.
James, I love talking to you about this stuff because I believe no one brings more common sense to this subject than you do. And before we get back to November 6th, what was your reaction to what Senator Elizabeth Warren did the other day? Thinking she was going to put the Native American thing and Pocahontas to rest. And by the way, I think she's been a fine United States senator. But every time I watch her do something like this, James, I think I'm going to be president before she is.
Well, first of all, let's deconstruct it. That is the stupidest thing I've ever heard. She mentioned in some speeches that her family law is they had Native American, right?
Right.
And they did an exhaustive investigation and determined that she'd never gotten. The sort of charge was that she got an appointment on the Harvard faculty as a kind of diversity thing. Well, there's evidence, total evidence of the contrary. But the Democrats are so steamed up about Trump, I think that she said, well, I'll do this and it'll embarrass Trump.
Right.
The mistake she made is nothing embarrasses Trump. And, you know, probably if they had a do-over, they should have done it at least after the election. I'm sure they'd figure that out by now. It's a tactical miscalculation, but I don't think in the long run it's going to matter a lot.
James,
it's got a lot of people like talking, and some people said they shouldn't have done it in the middle of the cycle because it takes away from Trump. That's fair enough.
James, when you look at, we don't even know what the Democratic field is going to be. We think we know what it's going to be. We don't know if Joe Biden is going to run, for example. We don't know for sure that Kamala Harris is going to run. We don't know that Cory Booker is going to run. But how frightened are you? And despite all the gains that progressives have made around the country, that if this party does go too far to the left and Donald J. Trump somehow survives his first term and actually fancies himself a two-term president, will it cost them dearly in November of 2020?
Well, it could. If it turns into an auction where we have, you know, Bernie Sanders, somebody said, hey, did free four-year college for everybody, and then somebody else comes in and says, well, free healthcare for everybody, and then somebody else comes in and, well, got a guaranteed government job. I mean, the party's in danger of holding an auction and not an election. So we got to get the auctioneer off the stage. I think that's number one. And, you know, we should embrace our tradition. I was reading, I think it was John Shake point. Franklin Roosevelt once said that a socialist is somebody with both feet in the air. A conservative has both feet on the ground but is incapable of moving forward. And a liberal is a person who has both feet on the ground and whose hands and feet work in coordination with their brain,
right.
Which I think is, so I hope we get somebody who has their hands and feet on the, you know, and works in coordination with their brain. But I am afraid that this thing could get away from us. I don't think it will, but it might.
We're talking with my friend James Carville on the Mike Lubica podcast. More with Mr. Carville in a minute. But first, a word from our friends at Geico. There's a quick way you could save money to switch to Geico. All it takes is 15 minutes to find out if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. And Geico offers coverage for more than just car insurance. Got a motorcycle? Geico's got you covered. Got an RV? Covered. Got a boat? Covered. How about a homeowner's or renter's insurance? You bet Geico's got you covered. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save. That's geico.com. We're talking to James Carville on the Mike Lubica podcast. James, Joe Biden's 75 years old. The other day he said age is a, quote, totally legitimate question if he were to run for office again. The only office he's going to run for would be president of the United States. He's only 3 years older than the current president of the United States. He would be 70 if he won. He would be 77 years old. Biden would on the day he was sworn in. Do you think that age is a totally legitimate question about someone who's in your demographic?
Yes, that's the answer. I do. And Joe Biden is one of the in many ways one of the most admirable people of my generation. And even Joe Biden himself says this is the issue. But all across the Democratic Party, we got these people running. We got some ton of new talent going to be taken to office here in November, and they got to be a pathway for them to get, to move up to. So I agree with former Vice President Joe Biden. His age is a very legitimate issue.
What about this notion that you hear floated sometimes that Biden runs with Kamala Harris with the stipulation that he will serve one term and then that obviously she would run for president in 2024?
That's too many people with too low IQ having too much time. I mean, you're going to go and say, all right, you're going to be there for four, and then you're just going to kind of pass the baton, and somebody said, well, excuse me, Could the voters be part of this backroom deal? And so that's going to make you look like you made a deal to, be vice president. And then, and every other Democrat is going to go like that and say, well, okay, Kamala, you cut the deal, so it's all yours. We're not going to get him trying to muck this parade up at all. I mean, that's that people are like, name your cabinet ahead of time. I mean, you hear that. I can say that's too many, too IQ points. Chasing too much time.
Do this for me, okay? Give me the dream Democratic candidate in 2020 who could beat Trump or Pence or whomever they will run from the wackadoodle side of the Republican Party, though actually it maybe the whole party is wackadoodle right now.
First of all, be able to speak clearly and articulately and to be able to advance the principles of the party. And a third thing that I think people are going to be looking for is that candidate would be someone that would convince other Democrats that they could win the general election and are going to go out and campaign all across America, not just in targeted Democratic places. Most people like myself became a Democrat because we didn't hate anybody. We just weren't against people of any kind of demographic or anything else. And now the Democratic Party has become the party of the anti-party of white working class people, which is stupid, which violates all of the traditions of the Democratic Party. And I want the next Democratic president to say, I'm not ceding that vote to anybody. I'm going to spend a lot of time in Western Pennsylvania and Southeast Ohio. I'm going to spend time, campaigning and convincing people that, hey, ours is the party that has your best interest. It traditionally has. I don't like this fraction of the electorate, and then everything is based on the algorithm that we can get one percentage point out more voters than the other side can. I think politics at some level is an emotional thing, and I think that a lot of Democrats I know are uncomfortable with the fact that, people who've been traditionally Democrats in their life and not only voting against us, but they think that we look down on them or we're against the way that they live. And that's just not a winning thing to me. It's really not.
Talking about emotional reactions, James, we're talking to James Carville on the Mike Lubick podcast. James, what is your emotional reaction to the relentless demonization from the other side of the Democratic Party? I saw an ad again in Florida the other day that makes it, they talk about James, and I'm not using hyperbole here, they talk about the Democratic Party like it's ISIS.
Right. First of all, like, one of my favorite people, and I think one of the most admirable people in the world, is Nancy Pelosi. That woman didn't even run for public office until she was 49, and she'd raised, I think, a fifth child was a senior in high school. And that is one of the most gracious, well-mannered people that I've ever met. And of course, she'd become totally demonized. I have no idea. She'd been married to the same guy, all of her adult life and all of her children's village. I don't know if anyone represents family values. But hey, look, if a party says that Newt Gingrich is the moral, keystone of our party, then that's fine. And Nancy Pelosi is somehow, there's something wrong with her. Well, that's your opinion. I can't change your mind, but you're certainly not going to change my mind.
And every time Trump comes out in favor of a Republican candidate somewhere. Have you, no, James, have you noticed they're all the same? Strong on borders, strong on the Second Amendment, love our vets, as though the Democrats are the enemy of all that.
Right. Yes, because I'm the enemy of the veterans and I'm the enemy of everything. And yeah, it's just him. I mean, look, he's in bed with the Saudis and the Russians and everything else. The people at Charlottesville, you know, some were really great people. There's no shock left anything he says. Really, it isn't. And if you try to unwind it, untangle it, you're just going to go deeper and deeper and deeper into the abyss.
James, what was your reaction to the way the whole Brett Kavanaugh thing played out? Or was that, you know, you've talked about all the things that are completely predictable right now, especially with this president. Was this predictable, too, that it was just another example of the tribalism of American politics right now, and that there was no nuance, there was no context? Either he was bad or she was bad, and to the point where even the president of the United States started mocking her at one of his Make America Great rallies.
But none of this would surprise any of us, no, would it? There's a large problem in this country, and we've just had in terms of time frame, we've had a burst of, you know, the workforce becoming more diverse, and the relationship between men and women, you know, things have changed, and they change fast. And the country is having to deal with that, and it manifests itself in a lot of ways. And I think that, you know, the whole Anita Hill, Dr. Blasey Ford, and all of that, all a part of the manifestation of that. And, you know, I think we'll come out of this fine, but we just had a lot of cultural changes in the United States, and we're seeing this. And also what happens is you have this, and the kind of nature of American politics is that everybody picks a side before the fight, and that's the side that you stay on, and even it's over. Kavanaugh is historically unpopular for Supreme Court justice, and I think in the long term, politically, he'll give the Democrats a lot of fodder. But, you know, basically, Mitch McConnell did is just stole a branch of government, and people are not happy about it at all.
Did the Kavanaugh thing in some way help Trump's base? Did it somehow energize them in a way that they weren't before the whole process started?
There is a strong feeling that happened. I think that the Republican, the Trump base voters are engaged. I saw a polling and good polling that indicated that was starting to be the case even before this issue became what it was. But they were going to get engaged anyway, and I don't think that the Democrats had much chance. This woman had come forward. She made a thing to be pretty believable, had made an allegation, and you got to put it forward. If you wouldn't have done that, it would have been really bad.
James, the last time we spoke, you sounded as if that you were not only passionate about the Democratic Party, but you are passionate about learning as much as you can about what all the internal polling right now. And when we last spoke months ago, you felt that this blue wave was coming. Now we're less than a month out. Do you still believe that it will be coming our way on November 6th?
I think it's going to be a blue year. What I'm concerned about is it's powder blue and not navy blue. All right? I'm not worried that it's not going to be blue. And there's a little bit of a difference in the polling data now because the macro polls, the big polls, if you look at like the congressional generic, as
right,
people call it, and that kind of thing, it looks good for Democrats. The smaller things look a little bit less encouraging. They'll all come together at the end. So if they take this Mitch McConnell thing about paying for the tax cuts with Social Security and Medicare, they'll win all the seats they can handle. If they try to stay unfocused and uncoordinated and try to run on five different things, then they're going to lose some seats they should have won. I think it's literally that simple.
He did step in it the other day, and you know, James, what you're saying is that the one of the things that Democrats have to do in the run-up to this election is to not continue to only suffer from Trump derangement syndrome and focus on guys like McConnell. Because James, when I look at Trump, we know who he is. Okay, it's like the old joke. Now we're just talking. We're quibbling over price. Okay, but he couldn't have done what he's done without an unindicted co-conspirator like Mitch McConnell. And McConnell, to me, I don't want to say he's as bad as the president, but he's pretty damn bad. And you're right. He gave the Democrats a gift this week that if they don't use, then it's on them on November 6th.
It was a fumble on the, you know, on their own 3-yard line. And we're just going to run, you know, 4 quarterback sneaks, and they know that we're running. I mean, it's the same thing. It just drives me nuts.
Are you still hopeful? James, are you still hopeful about this country? We keep hoping.
Yes.
You are? Okay.
Yes. I am, very.
And I promised you that before we stop talking today, we would talk a little college football, and I want to know where you watched last Saturday. Did you see this coming? And where do the LSU Tigers go going forward?
Well, it was unbelievable in the stadium. If they're able to beat Mississippi State, who's tough, the place could sell for a combust for Atlanta game. I mean, it's going to be huge. I mean, like in ways we can't even imagine.
You like this coach, James?
Well, I love the coach. I love him. He just got to win. That's his problem. You got to win. Just win. That's all. But he's a great guy. He's got that team. You know, that he started here. He didn't in April. He didn't have either a quarterback or a place kicker. He went out and he got both, and he got a pretty doggone good quarterback, and he got a great place kicker. So I'm optimistic. Yeah, I love Coach O. I really do.
Okay, now let me ask you this: sitting where you sit and rooting for whom you root, the LSU Tigers. How do you account at this time in college football for what Nick Saban has been able to do in Tuscaloosa?
It's the greatest football coach I've ever lived. Period. Not even close.
Even his old friend Belichick, James?
Not even college football coach.
Right.
Now, as a college football coach, he has no peer. And I mean, and a guy, you know, he won one with us. I don't know, he won 5 at Alabama. You know, he just is just amazing, and he's able to do it year after year after year. All right, I can't. We should have never left. We should have never left.
James, I've got a couple more minutes with James Carville, who's been incredibly generous again in transit today with his time. James, all the way to the run-up to the 2016 election, you never spiked the ball. You never thought it was over. You always had your concerns right up until the end about the way things were going and what might go wrong. And you were pretty clear on that. I think we both thought that Hillary was going to win, but we weren't sure that Hillary was going to win. And looking back now, how much did this come into play, that there were enough people in this country who thought to themselves, well, wait a minute. We elected the black guy twice. Do we now have to turn around and elect a woman? And do you honestly think that might have come into play?
I kind of don't.
You don't?
I think that, no. I agree with Kathleen Hall Jamison. I think the Russians did have some impact on the final election. And if you look at, you know, where the distribution was, I mean, actually the polling was not that far off. They had her winning by like 3.1, and she won by 2. And it was close in the places that it should have been close. And there was some, you know, some problem with people with her. Some people did vote against, I'm sure, that didn't like it because she was a woman. But I think there were, to be fair, there were other factors at play. I really do.
And my last question is this: watching the hearings with Dr. Ford and Brett Kavanaugh, and especially watching that Jurassic Park that was the Republican Party on this committee, do you start to think that term limits, even in the United States Senate, might not be a bad idea?
I think this is a very dark time in our political history, but I think we're underestimating how fast we can change. And let's see, in less than 3 weeks, we'll have a pretty good indication. But I'm not a pessimist about the United States at all. Jamie Dimon famously said, no one has ever gone broke betting against America. I mean, no one's ever gone broke betting on America. And I think that's true. I really do.
James Carville, thank you for doing this today. Thank you for taking time. People know what kind of wisdom James always brings to the various subjects we discuss. I'm lucky enough on this podcast every week to get to talk to people when they're willing that I want to talk to. Continue to download. Continue to subscribe. Leave a comment if you want to. And go LSU. I'll talk to you next week, everybody.
The Mike Lupica Podcast is produced and distributed by Compass Media Networks in conjunction with Hiltzik Creative. For iPhone users, go to the podcast app and search the Mike Lupica Podcast. Click on the Mike Lupica Podcast icon and subscribe. For non-iPhone users, you can listen on Google Play Music, TuneIn, Stitcher, or your preferred podcast platform.